The Music Lover by Jasper Lestrange. 1. Before she had even played a note, I knew she was the one. She had the right look, the perfect poise, a long slender neck and pale oval face framed by tumbling black curls. It was as if someone had breathed life into a Modigliani painting. Her figure was svelte but shapely, accentuated by a dress of black lace and chiffon, the hem of which grazed the floor. The long, elegant fingers of her left hand were coiled lightly around the neck of her instrument. Her right hand, holding the bow, was draped casually over the upper bout as she spoke to her immediate neighbour, another female cellist. The appeal was not purely aesthetic. There was something interesting about her, an indefinable yet magnetic quality, a certain way of being, not just of looking. It meant your attention was always drawn to her and not to the other perfectly but ordinarily attractive people around her. I found her at a performance of the City Chamber Orchestra. They were playing at a lovely old concert hall, a favourite of mine. Ornate and intimate, what I appreciated most was one's proximity to the players. To make best use of the space, tiered seating, starting at the edge of the stage, was positioned around an oval floor in the style of an amphitheatre. Large ensembles often spilled over from the stage and into the oval, close to the first row of seats. I always tried to get seats overlooking the string section. That evening, the programme was not to my own taste, being a selection of often heard pieces designed to introduce children to classical music, movements from Saint-Saëns' Carnival of the Animals, Holst's Planet Suite, an obligatory medley from the Nutcracker. But it is always a delight to hear a good orchestra play, and as a season ticket holder, I find myself less discriminating about the concerts I go to. I'm happy just to be there. And besides, living alone, what else would I be doing? While the musicians tuned their instruments, I found myself people-watching. Perhaps you do the same. Observe people when they're off their guard. Study their habits and mannerisms. Wonder about their lives. The program had drawn an audience of mostly young families with children, for many of whom it would be their first such concert. I watched the harassed mums and dads ushering their children to their seats, telling them not to shout, to mind other people, to sit quietly. I noticed it was the mums who generally seemed most harassed. I saw the irritation on the faces of more than one of them, sweeping their hair behind their ears as they bent over backpacks, rummaging for drinking bottles and bags of sweets, shooting exasperated glances at their oblivious husbands, already seated. It is the orchestra, not the audience, that most fascinates me, of course. And it was to the orchestra that my attentions were drawn. Not for the first time, I found its personnel confirmed various preconceptions and prejudices I have formed, the brass section being comprised mainly of overweight men stuffed uncomfortably into dinner jackets, the woodwinds a mixture of bohemian-seeming middle-aged women, ethereal young beauties, and sensitive young men with well-groomed beards. All stick thin. The percussionists somehow less like musicians and more like construction site foremen. Always busy. As ever, I was especially interested in the strings, which were dominated by female players, almost without exception, willowy, bright-eyed, and intelligent-looking. Only the harpist, a decidedly non-ethereal, rather portly young man, looked out of place. But overall, the makeup of the orchestra did little to disabuse me of the notion that musical ability is largely a question of genetics. I say that with some regret, for I have always considered myself as having lost out in that regard, being gifted with an excellent ear for music, yet cursed with small hands and weak, inflexible wrists that thwarted my attempts at playing, just as I was imbued with a romantic soul. Let down by plain, unremarkable looks. And so I have found other uses for my hands. Biding my time before the performance, idly surveying the faces in the room, I became interested in one of the piccolo players, white-haired woman in her late 50s, wearing a plain black caftan dress which she had attempted to enliven with a silvery shawl and a large brooch. I noticed how she always smiled at the young children on their way to take their seats. As is my habit, I began to sketch in the woman's personal history. Did she have children of her own, I wondered? They'd be grown up now, of course. I observed the lingering sadness in her smile when they passed. It was in her eyes, too. I saw the way she looked around the auditorium to distract herself. A slight shift in her posture and adjustment of her shawl, as if she felt a draught, a certain quick movement of the hands. I thought, perhaps, she had once had and lost a child. But then, seeing the absence of a wedding ring, decided that possibly she had never had children at all, and the look that haunted her eyes was regret. The second piccolo, sitting next to her, was one of the bearded young men. I could tell they didn't get on. There was very little interaction between them. Instead, he sat slightly twisted in his seat away from her, directing all his whispered conversation to the red-headed flautist next to him. From his manner and her responses, I deduced he was feeding her scandalous gossip about their colleagues. I didn't care for him. He had a supercilious air, and once or twice during the performance I noticed his lips curl into something like a sneer, as if he thought the material was beneath him. I continued in this vein, and had just finished furnishing a rotund tuba player with a backstory that included a marriage breakdown, diabetes, and a misspent youth with a northern colliery brass band, when I laid eyes on her. She had taken her seat among the strings and was chatting away. She was youngish, early 30s, I should have said, clearly from what we once, in more aspirational times, called a good family. But unlike the supercilious piccolo player, there was nothing snobbish in her demeanour. Instead, she had a refreshing approachability about her. An openness. Not quite girl next door, but not quite a girl in a tower, either. Her face was expressive, with dark green eyes full of life. Oh, I was at once taken with her. And naturally, when the concert got going, it was to her my eyes would always wander. During the faster, more bombastic pieces, with the lights dimmed, I would almost lose her in that blur of elbows and nodding heads moving rhythmically, mechanically. But during the quieter, lusher, romantic pieces, she truly stood out, as if the spotlights had quite deliberately chosen to illuminate her alone. She played Saint-Saëns' The Swan, arranged for cello and piano, and her body moved sinuously, seductively. Her face was all emotion, as though she felt every note. She was, is, quite stunning. Even though it is a small venue, I always bring my opera glasses. I used them to get a better look. Her face as she played conveyed such passion. I would have given anything for her to look at me that way, to inspire in her that same depth of feeling. But I am one of life's invisible people. Nobody would ever give me a second look, especially someone like her. But perhaps I could make her see me. That thought stayed with me throughout the second half, and when the concert had finished, and the sweating conductor had been brought back by the rapturous applause for several final bows, I lingered as the audience members began filing out of the auditorium, and the musicians gathered their things and themselves. I have already mentioned my ear for music. Perhaps I should go further and say that I am a good listener in general. I hear things that others might not notice. The compensation for my invisibility is the chances it affords me to observe, to eavesdrop, to overhear. What I overheard of the conversation between my cellist and her neighbour proved very valuable. For a start, it gave me her name. I heard the friend say, Tavi, a couple of times, which seemed odd until I double-checked the programme for the names of the cellists, and realised that she must be Octavia. Naturally, I smiled at the clear case of nominative determinism. Musical parents, I thought, and almost certainly with a classical education. I heard also the arrangements they made to meet on Friday, 2 days from now, obtaining both time and place. If I chose to, then, I could see her again, even though she wouldn't see me. When I made my way out into the cool night, I had a definite spring in my step. 2. One of the last inequalities to be addressed in the world is the immense privilege enjoyed by the attractive. Perhaps we who lose out in the genetic lottery are so eager, so desperate, simply to breathe the same air as the beautiful. We tend to forgive the advantages and opportunities that even an average level of attractiveness confers. We even seem to place the problems of the beautiful above the miseries of others, as if the suffering of the plain matters less, as if the ugly have only themselves to blame. I say this not to provoke, merely to explain. However kind and polite a woman like Octavia might be, however nice, the unspoken difference in our statuses precludes the straightforward approach. The attractive treat the unattractive like cattle, in that they prefer not to think of us as sentient beings at all. It makes it easier to put the bolt between our eyes and put us out of our misery. Octavia would no doubt have been greatly surprised by the longing I was capable of, the longing she had inspired. She may even have been frightened. But it was true that since seeing her, I had become infatuated. A side effect of living both alone and comfortably is that I have a lot of what you might call dead time. I seek no sympathy, for although I am undoubtedly lonely, I have never struggled to fill my hours and days. Perhaps having grown up in this house, for a long time just me and mother, then just me alone, I am used to it. I have my music, my hobbies, my collections, my thoughts, and, yes, my fantasies. I hadn't yet made up my mind whether I would go to see Octavia that Thursday. The day after the concert, I had researched her, though, done some digging. She was local, had joined the chamber orchestra recently, performed with a smaller ensemble too, played all over Europe, had even recorded and released half a dozen albums. As I have an extensive library of music, I immediately checked and was pleasantly surprised to find that I possessed one of her CDs, a lovely recording of Chopin's cello sonata in G minor. Delightfully, there was even a photograph of her on the back cover and in the booklet, looking deliberately sultry, no doubt at the behest of the photographer and marketing people, in a seductive red dress. As I sat in my music room, eyes closed, listening to her play, I imagined she was here with me, playing for me, sometimes in her black chiffon and lace, sometimes in red satin, her lissom body swaying, her eyes slowly closing and opening, the languid seesaw and bounce of her bow, the spider-like dance of her graceful fingers, up and down strings. You'll no doubt think me a foolish old man, but not for the first time. I allowed myself to entertain various notions. But it settled the matter, and when Thursday arrived, I arose much earlier than usual, excited for the rendezvous. I was so giddy with anticipation. I even put in some effort with my appearance, combing my hair and shaving, ironing my shirt. And as it was unseasonably warm and sunny, I put on my Panama, just in case she should notice me. Of course, in the end, she didn't. Not in that way. She was late arriving, as it happened. The other woman, Melanie in the programme, Mel in person, had turned up first, picking a table and chairs, then waiting. They were meeting in a park outside the old tea pavilion there. It was lunchtime, busy enough. The good weather had brought people out. Thankfully, I was still able to find an empty, adjacent table from which I could watch. From her lip biting, the drumming of her fingers on the tabletop, and her repeated scrutiny of the menu, I guessed she felt the anxiety some people feel at being alone in situations that are meant for couples and groups, an anxiety I rarely feel. On my way, I had bought a newspaper, reading matter, doubling as subterfuge, but she didn't catch me looking, so I continued to look. The waitress had taken my order and returned with it by the time Octavia finally appeared, some 15 minutes later. It is funny how different she was. Like day and night, really, which of course it was, in a way. At night, in the orchestra, she had been poised, elegant, perfectly controlled. Today, the girl, weaving her way through the tables, apologizing each time she caught someone with her shoulder bag, appeared stressed and chaotic. In fact, I might not have recognized her had she not been expected, and not just on account of the oversized dark sunglasses she wore. She was still apologizing profusely for being late when she joined her friend, who of course in turn told her it was fine. I confess to feeling slightly disappointed, a sense of anticlimax when reality does not conform to fantasy. It was not that I expected her to turn up in her concert attire, of course. No, she was younger than I had first thought. Mid to late 20s. Dressed young. She had on a hippie-ish floral shirt with a tie neck and baggy sleeves, ripped denim jeans, and a short faux fur jacket that she evidently regretted, since it was too warm, and which she took off at the earliest opportunity. The brightly coloured crochet bag she plonked on the table was adorned with numerous pin badges. Combined, the badges declared support for so diverse a range of political causes and charities that I realized they were displayed not as a manifesto, but as a protective shield. "I'm a good person. Don't hurt me," they screamed. I smiled wryly, but chided myself, for I don't mean to be cruel. Octavia's world was very different to mine, I reasoned. I have never had to try and fit in. I have never sought or acquired lasting friendships. I suppose, in a sense, I have never really been young. From what I read, hear, see of it, it must be exhausting. I could make out some of their conversation above the general hubbub, snatch here and there. I lip-read well, which made it easier. They ordered salads. Octavia suggested they share a side order of chips, then appeared to change her mind. Things were a bit tight this month, she said. Mel offered to pay, told her not to worry. Octavia wouldn't hear of it, but let the matter drop. They spoke of another girl, Clem, in terms which confused me at first, and I realized, somewhat surprisingly, that she was a child. Clementine, and must be Octavia's daughter, starting infant school that September. She was at nursery this afternoon, and her auntie was having her for a sleepover on Saturday. Whatever would she do without her? That moved the conversation from Clem to another person, a Luca, who turned out to be a man Octavia had started seeing. Her friend interrogated her for some time about him, their talk becoming shallow and rather silly. I confess I even started to go off her a bit. Something in the newspaper caught my eye. I must have tuned out of their conversation for a while, for when I picked it up again, they were getting ready to go. The waitress had brought the bill, and Mel again insisted on paying. There was a sudden awkwardness, coming from Octavia rather than Mel. I saw her touch her friend's sleeve and become very quiet and sincere. Could she ask a favour? Could she possibly lend her some money? Just £20 to get her straight. She didn't like to ask, and wouldn't, only how expensive everything is now, and a lot of things all coming at once. She would pay her back as soon as she could. She had some gigs coming up, a royalty check on the way. Mel was very kind, told her it was not a problem. Of course she would lend her the money. Was she sure 20 was enough? In the end, she gave her £60, which was all she had on her in cash. It was, truthfully, agonizing to watch. But what I'd overheard gave me hope. Octavia, Tavi, was struggling, in the way of a lot of creative people, I found. Her life was in disarray, disorder. She needed someone who could help her. She needed a benefactor. It was a part I was more than happy to play. They stood up to say their goodbyes, hugging and kissing the way young women often do. I poured myself another cup of tea, and after stirring, absent-mindedly tapped a cheerful tune with my teaspoon on the rim. I am a collector, and like all good collectors, I know to be patient. I know how to play the long game, as they say. I was confident that should I bide my time, a chance would present itself to have her see me, a chance for me to rescue her. And from there, well, who knew what could happen? In the meantime, I saw a lot of Tavi. She had given me plenty of opportunities to watch her. That next afternoon, I was there when she arrived, late again, to pick up her daughter. She had mentioned the nursery's name, and I followed them home. She is a dear little thing, the spit of her mother. Then, on Saturday, I was there when her boyfriend came to take her out. He turned up at the house on motorbike, wearing leathers. The face revealed when he took off his helmet was disappointingly, dispiritingly handsome, the bland good looks of a catalogue model. She seemed pleased with it, rushing out to greet him, jumping into his arms and wrapping her legs around him. I had already heard their plans, of course, so sat near them in a couple of bars and the pricey tapas place they finished up at. He naturally paid, and I was perfectly invisible the whole time. Unknown to them and unseen, I joined them on their slow walk back to her place, watched from the shadows as they stood kissing on her doorstep, heard her murmured invite, and saw him follow her inside. The door closed softly, the hall light shone through the panel of frosted glass, and then went off, and I felt altogether wretched, unwholesome, unwanted, infinitely lonely. I spent the remainder of that night, and the following night, in deep depression. I was so dreadfully unhappy, I couldn't even face being in the music room. But the opportunity to let Tavi see me came sooner than expected, and quite by chance. I hadn't even planned to see her that day. There I was in the bohemian part of the city, killing time in a cafe on a street of bric-a-brac shops, boutiques, artisan bakers, second-hand bookshops, watching the world go by through the big glass window when she passed. I almost missed her, but I caught a flash of the bag with the badges and recognized the dark glasses. My eyes watched her across the road and where she went. Then I hurried after her. "Please, I know you said 200, but I need it back this week," she was saying as I passed quietly into the shop. I already knew what she referred to because I had noticed it on the window on my way over. Her cello. "Look, love, I know you like to think I'm running a charity here," said the pawnbroker, "but I've got a wife and kids, you know, not to mention the rent on this place." "I can give you 150 today and come back to you with the rest next week," she said. "I've got a royalty check due any day and some paid gigs lined up." I didn't immediately make my presence felt. I pretended to browse, casting my eyes over the items on display. All kinds of gadgets, watches, jewellery, medals. There were, I noticed, quite a few musical instruments. Pawn shops are such desolate places, haunted by thwarted dreams, bad choices, dashed desires. This one reeked of desperation. "What if I give you this watch?" she said, displaying her wrist. "It's not worth anything," he frowned. I appeared at her side. "Sorry," I said. "I couldn't help overhearing. Is this about the cello?"
"Excuse me," said Octavia.
"What if it is?" said the pawnbroker.
"Again, apologies for intruding," I continued, addressing Octavia. "I am a collector of music. Not just records and CDs, but also instruments. I saw the cello in the window. It's a lovely piece of work. Does it belong to you?" "Yes," she said.
"Well, not at the moment," said the pawnbroker.
"Tell me to mind my own business," I said. "But I would happily settle the difference to help you get it back." She looked confused. "I'm sorry. Why would you do that? You don't even know me."
"Well, that's not entirely true," I said.
"What do you mean?" I turned to the man. "You are very privileged to have the talented young cellist, Miss Octavia Hart, as a customer." I turned back to her. "I am right, am I not?" Her cheeks reddened. "I wasn't sure," I said, "because of the sunglasses. But then, the cello." She was unsure what to say. So I went on. "I'm sorry, I don't mean to embarrass you. It's just, well, I happen to have some of your records. You're an exceptional musician. I'm not sure what has happened that has brought you here, but I can't bear the thought of you not being reunited with your instrument. I want to help." She bit her lip. I could see she was mulling it over. I knew she would be thinking there must be a catch, which, of course, there was. "If it's better, don't think of it as me doing you a favour," I said. "I'm a music lover. Your talent has given me so much pleasure. In many ways, it would be me returning a favour." "I just can't take your money," she said, looking pained. "Thank you, but it wouldn't sit right with me." The pawnbroker was watching our exchange, as if it was the strangest scene he had ever witnessed.
"I'd take him up on it if I were you, love," he told her.
"But I..." she began. "How much was it?" I asked the man.
200.
I passed him my card.
"Oh," said Octavia. "Oh, no, no, I can't let you."
She offered me the notes from her purse. "Here," she said. "That's £150. I can get you the rest soon." I refused the money with a smile that I hoped was avuncular. "You wouldn't be here if you had £150 to spare," I said. "Why don't you keep the money for now? Pay me back when you get yourself sorted." It was risky, I knew, just giving her the money like that. I had let her see me and provided an opening for her to see me again, but she had no need to. I was a stranger who meant nothing to her. In fact, if she couldn't repay me, or chose not to, she had an excuse not to see me. But my doubts were partially allayed when she said, "You're very kind. I can't thank you enough." She looked so genuine that I felt myself swelling with pride, despite my motives. She did not know, of course, that I knew where she lived, but I guessed she would be wary about giving me her address or telephone number. Instead, I jotted my own name and number down on the back of the receipt I'd been given and handed it to her, telling her to call me when she had the money, while reassuring her there was no rush. Her cello returned. We left the shop and talked briefly in the street. "Listen, you'll never know how grateful I am, but please don't tell anyone about today. If it got out somehow... well, you know how it looks." I stopped her.
"I know.
I understand. You don't have to worry. I'm very discreet." She smiled. "Well, thank you again for everything," she said. "You've been a bloody lifesaver. I'll pay you back, I promise." She patted my arm. The merest of touches. It was the first time I had felt the touch of another in a long while.
"Goodbye,
Octavia," I said.
"Ugh, horrible, stuck-up, pretentious name,"
she replied.
call me Tavi.
Those pretty dark green eyes twinkling, she stepped backwards from me, then turned, and I watched her disappear into the crowd. She really was, is, beautiful. Three. As you can imagine, the next few weeks were a nervous time. Now she had seen me, I felt it unwise to watch her as I had before, and fought the urge. I kept myself busy, dividing most of my time between my workroom, where I was making various necessary preparations, and my music room, where I listened to her play. Naturally, by now, I'd bought everything I could find that she played on. Like all collectors, I am a completist. It was a shame, I thought, that we could never be together in the true sense, in the way that I should have liked, and which occasionally I allowed myself to visualize. If she could get past looks, she might have found me a suitable partner. We shared a love of music, after all. She would no doubt be impressed by the size and range of my record collection, my good taste, although it was out of the question to ever let her see the music room. More than that, I felt that I would be a helpful, calming, steadying influence in her life, a father figure, a teacher, someone to knock off those rough edges. I could provide for her, guide her career. In me she would find a conversationalist, a companion, someone to expand her horizons and refine her tastes. And in bed? No doubt that is where she would become the instructor, but she would find me a willing, devoted, attentive student, ready to learn, eager to please. But in those moments when I allowed myself to dream, I also realized it was utterly hopeless. For there was always that other voice taunting me, the echo of my father and the overheard conversation with Mother.
He's no good, Marjorie. There's something wrong. Too much of your side in him.
I would recall his mockery, his insinuations. That dreadful afternoon when he took me to see one of his women. In that bare apartment, I cringed with shame and disgust when I remembered her attempts at seduction. The gap-tooth smile, the beauty spot, the suffocating perfume, my failure. And afterwards, the withering assessment she delivered to my father. Useless. When he died, and it was just me and Mother, things were a lot better. But his malign presence haunts these rooms and hallways still. I shall never be free. Thankfully, I will always have my music. It was about a month later when the telephone surprised me by ringing. It doesn't often. And naturally I rushed from my workroom to answer it.
Hello, is that Howard?
I was elated to hear her voice. I had begun to think she would never call. Yes, I answered.
It's Tavi,
she said.
You know, the cello lady. I wanted to pay you back.
Oh, there's really no need, I said.
No, I must.
She wouldn't like to feel obligated to me, I thought.
I did what you said, got things sorted. I'm doing okay at the moment, quite well, actually. I wouldn't feel right if I didn't give you your money back.
Well, that's jolly decent of you, I said. There was a pause.
I could meet you somewhere?
She said. It was time to play my hand. Or you could come to me, I said. I hope you don't mind, but... Well, I have something for you. A gift, if you like. Another pause. Experience would have taught her to be wary. I couldn't blame her. It would just be easier for me to show it to you here,
I said. I assume you're local.
Oh, she hesitated. Well, you shouldn't have. You've already been too kind.
As I told you, I'm a music lover. I admire your work. Well, you should know that I'm a dressmaker. It's uncouth to blow one's own trumpet, but actually, I'm a rather skilled one. You see, I took the liberty of making a concert dress for you. It would be an honour if...
Oh,
she said again.
Yes, I mean, wow, I don't know what to say.
Just say yes, I said. Come along and have a look. There's no obligation. If you don't like it, I won't be offended. It was on a whim, that's all.
Well, thank you,
she said.
I will, and you have got to stop being so nice. Where do you live?
I gave her the address. The arrangements were made. I put down the phone. In case you were wondering, it wasn't a lie. Those small, delicate hands I told you about, that had been so unsuited to the violin, happened to be rather adept at needlework. Partly owing to my mother's influence and training, I can turn my hand to all manner of textile work, including dressmaking. And I have a keen eye for fashion, especially female fashion. As it happened, the dress I had created for Octavia was nearly finished, clothing the tailor's dummy in my workroom. I would have to press on with it to have it ready for her visit in a day's time, when it would be moved into the living room. I was proud of it, though. It combined the elegance of the dress she had worn that evening at the concert hall with the sensuality of that red dress from her photograph. I suppose in the end it didn't really matter if she liked it or not, but I sincerely hoped she would. When the day came, I was on tenterhooks, all butterflies. So much was resting on everything going to plan. In the end, however, she caught me off guard by arriving early, and I had naturally expected her to be late. Hello, she said when I opened the door. She had no makeup on today, just fresh-faced and natural, and wearing her long hair in a fishtail plait. She looked somehow younger than ever, but every bit as breathtaking as she had on that first evening. It had been so long since I had last glimpsed her in the flesh. I had almost forgotten how lovely she was. Octavia, I said. I know, I'm early. I overestimated how long it would take to get here. I took a chance that you'd be in. I hope you don't mind. No, not at all. Please, come in. She wafted past me, and I took in her scent, which was fresh, citrusy. I looked out onto the road before I closed the door. There was no one about. Wow, she said. Some place you've got. Yes, I could never afford somewhere like this had I not inherited it. Even as it is, it costs a fortune to heat. I love the parquet. It can be cold in the winter. No, it's beautiful. Beats of silence. Oh, here, she said, fishing in her shoulder bag for something. She produced an envelope, which I guessed contained the £200 in notes. I wanted to give you a check, but I couldn't find my checkbook, so it's cash. I hope that's okay. I took it from her. Yes, and I trust everything's okay with you? Yeah, I'm all good now, thanks, she said, beginning to move out of the reception area, looking up at the high ceiling with its elaborate Victorian plaster coving. Well, not all good, but you know what I mean. It was just a little temporary cash flow crisis. Unfortunately, I don't have an inherited mansion, just rent and bills. She said it matter-of-factly, without sarcasm. It must be very difficult, I sympathized, distracted by a single thread of spider's web hanging from the globe-shaped chandelier. I was suddenly aware that we were standing very close to one another, having passed into the narrow hall. You mentioned a dress, she said. Yes, yes, of course. Follow me. I took her into the living room. My house is a big, three-story detached place at the end of a private road, with just two smaller houses on either side of the path leading up to it. Through the net curtains, a shaft of brilliant sunlight shone, motes of dust dancing in it. It formed a natural spotlight that illuminated the tailor's dummy, swathed in my dress for Octavia. Wow, she said, seeing it at once. It's stunning. Please, I said, encouraging her to take a closer inspection. It's beautiful. You made this. Designed by me, sewn by me, yes. Jesus, that's... I don't know what to say. She let her fingers caress the velvet. I can't take it. It must have cost a fortune. The material alone. Oh, you're worth every penny, I thought. Aloud, I said. Just stuff I had around the house. I'll have to give you something. The only thing I ask is to see you wear it, I said, appearing beside her. She seemed to start. I had made her uncomfortable. Of course, a woman like her must always be on her guard, and I was worried that I had been too bold. I mean, in concert, I said. It would mean so much to watch you perform in it. She looked around the room. Some of the paintings, ornaments, and furniture were mother's choices, not my taste at all. The violins and violas hanging on the walls were my additions, however, as were the various pieces of framed sheet music. You really are a music lover, she said. Oh, this isn't even half of it. Do you play yourself? Badly, I said. I could never stick with the lessons. My hands are the wrong shape, I think. Rubbish. Anyone can learn. It's never too late. You just need a good teacher. Perhaps you could teach me, I thought. Who's this? She was looking at a framed photograph on the mantel shelf. It showed a woman sitting, holding a violin. Ah, my mother. A very talented musician. As you can see, a violinist. I inherited the house and everything in it, but none of her talent for music. Sewing and dressmaking, on the other hand, she taught me everything I know. Oh, I wish I could sew, she said. Unfortunately, I can't even mend a pair of socks. That's a pity. It's a handy skill to have when you've got young children, I said, before I could catch myself. I'm sorry? When you have children. If you have children, it can be useful. Or so I've heard. I don't myself. And you're much too young, of course. She smiled then. I'll have to come to you for lessons. If I had thought for a second that she wasn't speaking in jest, things might have gone differently. Look, it's not often I get a real live musician in my house, I said. Please say you'll stay for a cup of tea. I can't hang around too long, she said, consulting her watch. But she was too polite, too well brought up, to leave so briskly, especially after the generosity I had shown. I've probably got time for a cuppa, though. Excellent, I said. Wait here. I left her in the living room while I made the tea. When I returned with the pots, cups, and saucers on a tray, she was sitting on the settee expectantly, her hands clasped between her legs, her green eyes smiling. She had taken off her coat to reveal a simple white blouse with buttons, almost like a man's shirt with the sleeves rolled up. Her coat was on the arm of the chair, along with her bag. The tea things I set down on the small table between us. My hands were trembling as I passed her the cup, the teaspoon rattling on the saucer. I hoped my nerves would not betray me. But she was as she had seemed when I first saw her, open, approachable, responsive, charming. And we were soon talking quite happily. She told me all about her music career, where she had studied, who she had studied under, the various ensembles and orchestras she had played with, the records she had made,
a little about her family. Divorced parents who were preoccupied with new partners and new lives. And I told her about Mother, her own musical career, our hobbies, some of them, our contented life together, and then her sickness, and how I cared for, fed, bathed and dressed her, until she finally passed away. I was guarded, eager not to reveal too much, as was she. She didn't mention the boyfriend, and I could tell she was careful not to bring up the daughter, but I could tell she felt sympathy for me. Without overstating it, I told her how lonely I had been since losing Mother, and how music had grown to become such an important part of my life. By the end, we were chatting like old friends. Even so, I was surprised when, with bright eyes, she put down her cup and said, "Do you mind if I try it on? The dress, I mean." I was just pouring myself a fresh cup. "After all, you were so kind to make it. You should absolutely see it on." "Yes, and then if there are any alterations," I started. "No, it looks perfect. You have such a good eye." There was silence. "Is there somewhere I can get changed?" "Of course, yes. Mother's room. It has the biggest mirror." I led her up the staircase and along the corridor. "So many doors," she said. "It's a bit of a rabbit warren, isn't it?" I replied. "And of course, a lot of the rooms I hardly ever go in." Up another flight of stairs to the second floor. "A lot of stairs," she said. "Yes," I puffed. "Three stories and a basement. Maybe I should move in." "Here we are," I announced, opening the fourth door along the passage. I let her pass me into the room. It has barely been touched since Mother died. I still have her clothes, her jewelry, her perfumes, all just as she left them. The stale, fusty odour that clung to the walls, carpet and furniture contrasted with Octavia's clean, fresh scent. "Do you mind?" she asked, indicating the bed. I hesitated. Oh yes, no, by all means." She put her bag down on top of the bedclothes. It would have makeup, of course, in it, hairbrush, etc. She wanted to see the full effect. As did I. I laid the dress down next to it with unintended ceremony, and realizing I was lingering, nodded and backed out of the room, closing the door after me. "I'll wait for you downstairs," I called.
"Okay."
For the next 10 minutes, I felt the way I imagine a groom feels on the morning of his wedding. My stomach was in knots, my hands clammy. "There is a record player downstairs, as well as the one in the music room." I thought some music was in order, and within moments the strains of Albinoni were wafting through the house, ready to accompany her descent. I boiled a kettle for more tea, and I had brought the fresh pot through to the living room and taken my seat when she reappeared. "What do you think?" she asked, framed by the doorway. She stepped into the room, did a slow half turn to show off the dress. I stood up, clutching my teacup, and approached her. "I love it," she said. "It's probably the most sensational thing I've ever worn." I was speechless. Temporarily. "Beautiful," I said finally. "I mean, it looks beautiful on you." "It's a work of art," she said, looking past me into the mirror above the fireplace. "Like you," I felt like saying. I was watching her reflection in the mirror. I stirred my tea. I was so excited, I tapped my little leitmotif on the side of my cup again. And I noticed the face in the mirror change. It was a crease of the forehead, a slight movement of the eye as she tried to recall. Where had she heard that before? Luckily, I had brought something else from the kitchen, something I now carried in the inside pocket of my tweed jacket. My hand twitched. I would have to act fast. But her confusion passed. She came nearer. We were standing so close that, were I not so restrained, I might have tried to kiss her. I wanted to. She was looking up at me with such sincerity. "Do you know what you are?" she said. "You're like my guardian angel." As you can imagine, this was music to my ears. Perhaps now there would be no need, but just then we heard something. Upstairs, a melody, and a vibration. "My phone," she said. "It's in my bag upstairs. I must get it. It could be important, of course. A work call. The boyfriend. More likely about her daughter," I thought. "The nursery calling her. About illness or a bump on the head." She was already bounding up the stairs to answer it when something flashed across my mind. A terrible oversight that made me dash after her at once. I was at the foot of the stairs when she reached the first floor. I heard the scream when I reached the second. She was standing in the doorway of the third room alone, her hands raised in shock. In the nick of time, I managed to get one arm across her chest and the other around her shoulder. She struggled, tried to cry out, but the chloroform pad was already smothering her mouth and nostrils. "Oh, my dear. Oh, my love," I whispered. "Don't fight it. Don't fight it. Shh. 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 4. Had she not opened the wrong door, things might have been very different. Then again, had she not surprised me by arriving early, the door would surely have been locked, as I tend to keep it. And in the end, she had been so nice, I had almost decided to abandon the idea. But her seeing the music room rather forced my hand, so to speak. It's a shame she didn't like what she saw. In many ways, it's my finest work. Such attention to detail. Such fine stitches. She's a slip of a thing, of course. Nothing to her. Yet it was still a struggle to get her downstairs. Down to the cellar where she is now. In my workroom. Do you ever wish you could freeze time? Like a photograph. Or a compact disc on pause. I wish we could have stayed locked in that wonderful moment. When she gazed up at me with those shimmering dark green eyes. Quite hard to match, but I think I have the colour right. The world outside is already buzzing with the talk of her disappearance. People go missing all the time, but the TV and newspapers seem to like it best when it's a beautiful woman. The photo of her in the red dress is everywhere. I am quite confident nobody will look for her here, though. No one ever sees me. Perhaps later, I could coax her into giving a solo performance. She will be angry, no doubt, and scared, naturally. But I can be quite forceful when I need to be. Whatever happens, it will be a swan song. Like all collectors, I am a completist. So she will have to go to the music room to join the others. First violin, second violin, viola, and now cello. They will never play live, but they are so nice to look at. Thank you. Today's story was The Music Lover. It was written and read by Jasper Lestrange. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, sweet dreams.